Hello, podcast listeners. We know podcasts are a great way to catch up on a program that you may have missed on KSJE, and it's provided as a free service of this radio station. But you know, KSJE is now listener-supported, and so while you enjoy this podcast, we hope that you'll also take some time to join KSJE. Become a member today. It's quite easy to do. Just go to our website at ksje.com/support and pick the level of support that best matches your budget. Thanks again for listening. Here's your podcast. San Juan Regional Medical Center is your community hospital, committed to making life better for the communities we are privileged to serve. In fact, better is our mission, improving lives through personalized health and care. What matters most to our patients matters most to us, offering a comprehensive range of inpatient, outpatient, and emergency care services so you can get the quality care you need right here at home. San Juan Regional Medical Center, celebrating life better here since 1910. KSJE is supported by the Farmington Civic Center, presenting A Christmas Carol, Friday, December 23rd at 7:30 p.m. The true spirit of Christmas in this production, filled with haunting special effects and heartfelt sentiment. A powerful story of redemption, Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol has enchanted audiences the world over with its simple message of holiday joy. Friday, December 23rd at 7:30 p.m. at the Farmington Civic Center.
Past 8 o'clock. It is Thursday morning, the very first day of December 2022. Good morning, everybody. I'm Scott Micklin. Thank you for tuning in to KSJE 90.9 FM here in San Juan County, New Mexico. In Durango, Colorado, of course, we are broadcasting at 103.3 FM. And anywhere else on earth, you can always tune us in from our website, ksje.com. Welcome also to our viewers, because this is a community-supported visual radio station. So the video of this program is streaming out live this morning to the KSJE Facebook page, our YouTube channel, and our Twitter account. So wherever you want to watch us, you can do that as well. We're glad that you are with us, everybody, because coming up this morning, my guest on the program, archaeologist Paul Reed, is back with me for his regular visit. And this month, our focus is on archaeological tourism, and we'll talk more about that in just a moment here on KSJE. Then later on this morning, we'll be checking in with River Reach Foundation about their annual River Glow event, which is happening tomorrow evening along the Animas River. So we hope you'll join us for that later on at 8:50 a.m. here on KSJE. Next hour, Mick Hess, of course, with our classical music program, Roving with the Arts. Mick is playing some selections from Bach this morning, so enjoy that next hour here on the radio. And of course, if you're an Instagram person, we remind you that you can connect with KSJE on our Instagram page as well. And if you're a podcast person, you can connect with us on our podcasts as well. Their podcasts are located wherever you listen to podcasts, I bet. Places like iTunes and Spotify and iHeartRadio and Google Podcasts and Pandora, and the list goes on and on. So subscribe for free and get alerted to the newest podcasts from all of us here at KSJE. Outside our studios this morning here at San Juan College, it's sunny and 29 degrees at the moment here in Farmington. The forecast calls for some increasing clouds today, but some mild temperatures. Take a look. This afternoon's high, 58 degrees in Farmington. Should be a pretty mild night so far for the Christmas parade, which will start at 5:30. I'll see you downtown Farmington for that event later on today. The winds will pick up overnight, though, with a low of 39 tonight. And then tomorrow, a windy Friday in store with a high of 52 tomorrow. And a partly cloudy night on Friday night with a low of 33. Partly sunny skies on Saturday, the high 55, 57 on Sunday, 55 again with partly sunny skies on Monday. Well, let me introduce my guest, who is with me this morning, back once again for his regular visit with me, which I so appreciate. Archaeologist Paul Reed is joining us this morning by a remote hookup this morning. Paul, good to see you. Good morning.
Scott, good morning. So glad to be back on with you.
Thank you very much for joining us. And as I mentioned, our topic this morning, this idea of archaeological tourism, and I was kind of looking at an article. It was an opinion article, I think, in the Washington Post. Let me call it up here for a moment. Talking a bit about the discovery of the King Tut's tomb in Egypt, which happened gosh, 100 years ago, I guess, in November, and I was kind of thinking back, not that I was alive 100 years ago, but thinking back to how things have changed in the last 100 years, and I guess just how amazing that discovery was at that time, because I would think, and you will correct me if I'm wrong, that a lot of those tombs had been kind of raided and desecrated and things removed, but Tut's was seemingly pretty well intact when it was discovered, and that's maybe what made it so unique. Am I correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Scott. And I think it's fair to say that the discovery of King Tut's tomb really kind of revolutionized the public's interest worldwide in Egypt specifically, but also just in archaeology. So yeah, pretty phenomenal thing. And yeah, they're still discovering things to this day in different sort of stretches of, you know, the deserts of Arabia. Right. So it's pretty remarkable. Definitely.
Right. And you always remind us that it's kind of important to know the context of how these artifacts may have been discovered, right, as they're lying around or what have you. And if someone moves something, then that kind of destroys that whole idea. And so by finding this entire tomb and these multiple rooms that really were seemingly untouched since they were sealed thousands of years ago, that really made it really special, wasn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, people, I think rightly in some ways really focus on the treasures and the riches that were buried with this individual. But to kind of get beyond that part of it, it's exactly what you're saying. It's the context, it's the data, it's the knowledge that archaeologists were able to, you know, look at, study, and understand from having this series of sealed rooms and this individual laid to rest, and really with no disturbance for over 3,000 years. So that is truly the remarkable part. And I think it's that thrill of sort of undisturbed discovery that really is part of what drives the durable interest in things like this.
Right. And was that at the top of mind for these archaeologists back 100 years ago? Were they looking or noting the location of things and the context of things, or were they just kind of looking at all the riches and saying, wow, look at what we found here?
Well, you know, the way we talk about this period, you know, is definitely different than the way they thought about it at the time. We have the benefit of 100+ years of reflection and sort of the evolution of anthropology and archaeology. So I do think they were very focused on the material remains. And, you know, a really well-known archaeologist, David Hirsch Thomas, who is at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, wrote a book called Skull Wars, talking about basically sort of this worldwide exploitation of archaeological sites by, you know, mostly folks of European American descent, going to different areas. And he describes this period in American archaeology and worldwide to an extent as the collecting phase. So it was really about trying to find remains that were felt to be interesting and significant, and to really, you know, populate, if you will, the museums of mostly the East Coast in America, the British Museum, the Louvre, you know, many places in Europe as well. So the focus really was on extracting these items thought to be of great value. And, you know, and the desire to understand scientifically what was going on was definitely there, but I don't think the emphasis was nearly what we would put on it today.
Got you. And of course, again, these items were, as we see in the article, right, these pieces of gold and jewels and things along that line, which, I mean, in these rooms were filled with these types of items, if I remember my history correctly. And so I would assume that they were just overwhelmed with all these different very, very valuable artifacts when they broke open those seals and went into those rooms for the first time.
Right. And again, as you noted at the outset, just thrilled that they actually had found an undisturbed context and that those items were there. They could be studied, they could be photographed, and then they could, you know, be extracted and saved. And, you know, there's still a traveling King Tut exhibit that, you know, makes its way around the world. So I mean, it's, you know, I don't want to put the wrong light on this entirely, because so many of these tombs in Egypt were raided by people who pulled the items out, and those may be in private collection hands, you know, 100, 150 years later. They may have been sold, melted down. I mean, you never know what people who are primarily interested in, in enriching themselves
Right.
from archaeological sites here and there are going to do with it. So the fact that we have this amazing exhibit, or this vast collection that, has traveled as an exhibit is phenomenal. And that's, we wouldn't understand this if we didn't. So it's
Right.
a great thing.
And to be shared with the public for sure. But I know, and we talk a little bit about the museums and things along that line, but that brings up kind of the idea of this archaeological tourism. And so I think at this time in this article, this opinion piece goes into it that the Egyptians were really interested in maybe, exploiting, for lack of a better term, of what this might mean for their country and their tourism industry, right? That you can maybe open up these sites to the public and offer tours and get interest in the culture and things like that, which is what I think this discovery also meant for that area of the Middle East, right?
Right, absolutely. And if you think about where Egypt was 100 plus years ago, we knew about oil. They had done some oil extraction, but there wasn't some of the wealth that we see, and not necessarily in Egypt, but in other countries in the Middle East. So the idea of archaeological tourism definitely represented an economic opportunity, and it still does to this day. I mean, I'm not sure what the tourist industry in Egypt generates, but it's definitely billions of dollars, and they have millions of people go to Egypt to experience the pyramids and other amazing sites there. So yeah, that's a positive thing. One of the things we've talked about a little on the show, of course, is how to balance tourism and keep it at a level where you're not impacting either the cultural or the natural resources that are bringing people in from your own country and worldwide as well. So that I think is the fine line that, we have to walk on these things. But the more people understand and appreciate, I think that does have a very positive effect on how people, if they're just out somewhere, would treat remains that they would find with greater respect. So that's definitely the hope as we see archaeological tourism, really increasing over
Right,
time.
right. And to bring it back here, I mean, again, we've got multiple sites in our backyard, literally, that deal with archaeological tourism. Of course, Salmon Ruins, of course, that you have worked with, Aztec Ruins and Chaco Canyon all come to mind. Mesa Verde, we have a number of sites here that, while they are, helping us to understand the area in which we live, they are also open to some degree to the area and to tourists to come and visit to see kind of what it's all about, what these sites are all about, right?
Right, exactly. And that's, as we look at sort of the evolving economy of the American West, archaeological heritage tourism, cultural tourism, natural tourism, and sort of blurring that line because folks go out and they see natural sites and cultural sites, and that is a huge part of the economic present and future for the Four Corners and much of the American West. So yeah, we're going to continue to do this, and that's brings to mind the need to have the best possible interpretations, and again, back to our, our theme for the year, to really make sure that we're representing attitudes, the perspectives, the understandings of indigenous folks when we're bringing people to see sites that were created by their ancestors. So yeah, that's, it's back to thinking of this as a very exciting time and a transition into something that is probably going to be a little different than what we've been doing.
Right, very true. And for places like Chaco and Aztec, which are kind of overseen by the federal government, the National Park Service, as we can see, of course, and then, of course, you have a site like Salmon that is really managed by the county and more local efforts. All these entities have different policies and rules to try to guide the discoveries and the interpretations and the interaction with the public, right, into those sites.
Right, exactly. That there's definitely variation. I think sort of the what unites sites, no matter what jurisdiction, they're managed by, is that we want to protect those and preserve them for the future. So we want to have policies in place that allow folks to visit with respect, understand, and to do that. And we want to have appropriate measures in place to protect places if, there are folks who want to pick up artifacts or potentially do other harm to places. By and large, we have, 90% or more of our visitation to places like this and even remote places done with a whole lot of respect. And without any impacts to sites. But, you know, what we have seen, you know, since COVID sort of gripped us a couple of years ago, is that more and more places have been visited. And even to have people respectfully visiting remote places in particular, it increases the load on, you know, trail creation and potential impacts to sites, items being picked up and moved or potentially taken away from those sites. So, you know, it does remind us of the need to have really active management, especially of remote places.
Yeah, it's almost as if we are loving these sites to death. And I know folks don't mean to
exactly.
to harm them, but it just is from the sheer numbers, I guess, of folks, correct?
Right. And, you know, it does speak also to the need to just have really good staffing in our National Park Service and the BLM, Forest Service, and other agencies that are managing these, and really to continue to look for avenues to fund tribes in the lands that they manage so that they have adequate folks on the ground to ensure the protection of these places.
Right, right. Very true. My guest this morning, archaeologist Paul Reed, is joining me. We are talking about, of course, his field of archaeology, the idea of archaeological tourism, which certainly is thriving in across the world these days. And Paul, I wanted to go back to this whole idea 100 years ago in Egypt and elsewhere, where it seemed like, and with a lot of these discoveries, as we mentioned, you know, a lot of the artifacts were carted off out of these countries to museums. It was probably these countries that paid for a lot of these expeditions, I guess, and put up the money. So I guess they felt a certain ownership of whatever was found, kind of the finder's keeper's rule, I suppose, back in those days. Is that what we had and how we're evolving from that as things maybe are repatriated now back to these countries of origin and these peoples that have these really cultural ties to what was found?
Right, right, exactly. So during that period in particular, and this happened in the American West and many, many regions around the world, again, you know, expeditions funded archaeologists, people who were beginning to have some training at that time period, but many were sort of in the class of the Indiana Jones type explorers, adventurers, going and getting items, extracting them from places and bringing them back then quite a ways away, maybe around the world or across the country from their points of origin. And, you know, this is what happened at the time. It's not a practice that we would condone today by any means. You know, and in some cases, I think it's fair to say, maybe particularly in the case of King Tut's tomb and the findings there, that finding those and protecting them was very important compared to, you know, just the years, the decades, the centuries, really, in Egypt, of different groups going in and raiding tombs, taking items for their own uses. But, you know, as we've kind of moved through the 20th century and into the early 21st century, you know, we're having a different perspective on this. And as you noted, you know, in America, we've gone through a process with the Native American Grave Protection and Repatriation Act, where museums are required to inventory the people, the human remains that they're holding in their museums and items of cultural patrimony that different tribes in America might be interested in getting back. So we've done a whole lot of repatriation there. There's still quite a bit to do. And then worldwide groups are, you know, starting to speak up about this. And most countries at this point, Scott, and I'd say this is on a scale of 30, 40 years, essentially have rules that if you go in as an archaeologist to work, say, in Costa Rica or Peru, they won't actually let you remove any of the items and bring them back to America. So the idea is if you're going to do that, you partner with archaeologists from that country. You do the work carefully, respectfully, and then the items stay in that country. And then if there's to be museum development and that sort of thing, then that is worked out in the country of origin. So, you know, and Egypt, I think, has been able to get many items back that were in different places. And, you know, now they have pretty amazing facilities in Cairo and other locations in Egypt where they can display their country's cultural patrimony and really put that on display. But, you know, there are many, many millions of artifacts that are still out of context in places. You know, the British Museum does come to mind as a place that has, you know, items from all over the world. And certainly a level of protecting those and keeping them safe from, you know, private sale and et cetera. But I know that more and more countries are also talking to big European, Western European museums and saying, hey, we'd like to work with you to get some of these items back. the trickiness comes into play when you think about sort of modern economic value, especially for items of gold or, you know, that are considered to be very valuable. So anyway, that sure. gets into tricky issues of how you fund getting items back. You know, in the Southwest, groups like Zuni, Hopi, and Acoma have been successful in a few prominent cases in getting shields and masks back from collectors, museum facilities in the U.S. and in some cases in Europe. So I think we're kind of heading in a positive direction,
right,
in terms of letting, you know, groups manage their own cultural heritage, their own cultural patrimony, and sort of getting beyond the idea of these items have great economic value to, you know, Western people or maybe to worldwide people. And then what that does, if we put too much value on that from a modern economic standpoint, it kind of strips the cultural context from those items. And that's an issue that I think we're still sort of grappling with. You know, and that's about, if these are going to be in museums and on display and people can enjoy them, then we really need the full richness of interpretation that comes from whatever group's ancestors created the items to have their interpretations part of that understanding.
Right. Very true. And I would say, I was going to bring up, I think you mentioned kind of the idea that some of the tribes in the area have been working with some of these other parties to get some items returned. I think a prominent case was, maybe if I remember correctly, was it in France that there was a shield or a mask that was returned somewhat recently, right, Paul Reed? Is that what I'm remembering?
Yeah, that was an arrangement that the Pueblo of Acoma was, yes, able to work out.
Thank you.
You know, unfortunately, there are many auction houses still worldwide, particularly in Western Europe, that aren't really mapping onto that. And again, they're just looking at the objects as, you know, with their modern economic value. You know, and in cases of sacred objects, that to me does clearly override whatever economic value might be put on these items. And so, you know, I think that's part of what I have seen with museums and hope to see more of, which is an evolution in what I would describe as responsible stewardship of items. And if museums are approached in this country or anywhere in the world by groups who say this is an item that, you know, is part of our cultural patrimony and our deep heritage, you know, then maybe the museum goes through a process to be sure that, you know, is a valid claim, but then they move forward and repatriate those items. You know, there is some legislation that just passed in the country, and I think the president will sign it, that's called the SAFE Act, which is about protecting items of importance to tribes and preventing those from leaving the country. So that's a big step forward, and this is something that groups have worked on for a couple of years.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, we're seeing improvement, and, you know, just so folks are clear, this is not about driving the U-Haul rental trucks up to every museum in America saying, hey, we're emptying them all out, you know. That is not the issue at all. It's a question of working with the groups whose heritage is being managed, presumably studied, understood in different ways, and being sure that those groups have access to objects that are important to them, and that they then, if they feel that they should be repatriated, and they can go through a process to do that, you know, to do that with respect and, you know, with good working arrangements with,
right,
the museum. So,
right,
again, we're evolving, and, you know, we're going to end up in a different place here. You know, one of the concerns for tribes, of course, is if they don't have their own museum facilities, then they don't want a truckload or five truckloads to pull up in front and say, hey, here are all these items back. So we have to work very carefully to figure out how to responsibly repatriate, if we're talking about a lot of items, and to work with the concerns that each group might have.
Right. Very true. Well, and I guess to take the standpoint of the museum, and I've not been to the British Museum, but I would assume that many of these museums would say, look, we have provided safe storage, safe exhibition of these items for all these years with context, and we've invested all this money into research and trying to tell this story, and we've been able to expose these items in our exhibit to all these different members of the public who come to our museum to see them. And so in that of itself is somewhat of a positive thing, is it not, even though it's not in their country of origin?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's definitely the stewardship side of what different museums have done for decades or centuries is to get items and to preserve them and protect them. And that I think we do owe a debt of gratitude to different places for doing that and protecting items from looters and just sale on a private market. So the real issue though comes into being or into focus if the museums are approached by groups who say these items are important to us. It's not about the economics of it. We're not going to get them back and then go sell them ourselves, in a legal or illegal context. These are very important items to our country, or to our tribe. So let's find a way, to work this out. And again, we're not talking about, flying over the C-130s and, emptying out anywhere.
Sure.
But just really trying to bring a different perspective, a different philosophy, to how we think about displaying, interpreting, talking about cultural property and heritage of these many diverse groups. So again, I'm encouraged that we're heading towards a much more diverse and varied interpretation as we look at things, and that we realize that the scientific archaeology perspective is an important one, but it is only one perspective as we try to understand things that happened in the past, whether we're looking at items, sites, landscapes, kind of the whole package of cultural work and archaeological work.
Right. And as we've discussed here on this program this year, Paul Reed, and you've been really great in bringing in some really important guests who have given us that perspective from the tribal perspective of that, when they discover an item that is really culturally significant to their tribe, to their culture, and approach these institutions, these museums, these collectors, whomever we're talking about, that maybe their voices are a bit louder these days and a bit stronger than they had been 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And so maybe some of these institutions are listening a little bit more closely and actually coming to the table and negotiating the return of some of these significant pieces than maybe they were less apt to do in the past.
Right, exactly. And the federal legislation, the NAGPRA law
That
has
doesn't
been
hurt.
huge in that regard. But getting beyond sort of the letter of the law, it's more the spirit of let's work with groups whose items, we have decided to store and caretake and perhaps interpret and put on display and exhibit, et cetera. And let's do that in a much more responsible way. And sort of get beyond again our Western scientific bias of, well, here's what a museum does. We hold these items, we display them, et cetera, or we keep them in storage. And because I think what I've seen working with different indigenous groups is tribal members want access to artifacts to see them, to understand them, and to really come to an understanding about how those artifacts from ancient sites, fit into the ceremonial lives, their normal lives, the things that they're still doing today. And I've seen that as well with visits to different points on the landscape, either archaeological sites and other places. So, for many indigenous folks, from what I've learned in about a decade of working fairly closely with groups, is it's about the connection to these places. And they see items in museums a lot of times as severing that connection for them. So, the best case scenario, I think, for a lot of Indigenous folks is that these items would not have been removed at all from different field contexts. And, obviously, we can't go back and redo some of those things. But it is a very good point as we look towards the future of archaeology, and whether we really need to excavate or collect or remove objects from the field if we're able to study them and leave them in protected contexts on sites, I think. Anyway, from what I've heard from my
Right.
Indigenous colleagues, that really is the best way to do it. Because
Sure.
then we haven't taken them out of context. They're not in a museum setting. And they're in their minds. And I think the perspective I've come to, they're where they're supposed to be, which is out on the landscape in the places where they were left.
Right. But there's a record of it, and so we know what's out there, I guess, right, after they've been noted and mapped and things like that.
Right. And there is some risk for sure of sites being out in places and the objects still being out there of impacts, looting, destruction, vandalism.
Sure.
But it's just part of what we have to manage as we think about these issues.
Right. Well, and the public is educated a bit, too, about the penalties for removing some of those things and having them in your possession and what have you. So, Paul, we are just about out of time this morning. It happens to us every time we get talking about this stuff, and the clock just runs past us. But I would so appreciate your insights into this topic. I thought it was really interesting. Thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you, Scott. I appreciate you bringing the topic to our discussion today. And lots of interesting stuff. I don't think we'll run out of topics.
I don't think so either. And I'm grateful for that. So I'm thankful in this season of Thanksgiving for you. And we'll have a Merry Christmas, you and your family. We'll talk to you in the new year.
Thank you, Scott. Same to you, sir.
All right. Thank you. That's Paul Reed, archaeologist. He works with the Selman Ruins and Archaeology Southwest. My guest here on KSJE. KSJE and San Juan College present the Student Success Coaching Tip of the Week.
Week 15, don't cram. While it may seem like a good idea to learn an entire semester's worth of information in one night, it's not an effective study habit, and it can cause a lot of unnecessary stress. Instead, study a little bit of information every day for at least 20 to 30 minutes. You'll likely remember more later, and you'll feel calm and prepared when it comes to exam time.
The Student Success Coaching Tip of the Week, presented by KSJE and the Student Achievement Center at San Juan College.
Did you enjoy that podcast? We hope that you did. And if you did, share it with your friends. And if you really want to keep podcasts like this coming, please support KSJE. You can do it easily online at ksje.com.